It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
We have two more hours of this.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Happy St. Patrick's Day. May the luck of the Irish be with you. This is episode 853 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, March 17th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. It felt good to get some gaming content up this week for the first time. Went hands-on with WWE 2K24. And you can find that content up on the YouTube channel. Hopefully I'll have another episode going up in the next few days. But right now, we got a lot of news to get into, so let's not waste any time here. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers this week. If you want to make a donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. I want to say thank you to Big B, Brian Becerra, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Road Warrior, Roderick Welch, Brandon Ring the Damn Bell, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Gentleman Masher Shane Maniacci, Killshot Keith Hart, Best in the Game Trey Porter, and Ms. Madness Michelle Mills. I will go to war with that group. I will take that group and put them up against anybody. So thank you very much for the support this week. Keep reviewing the show. Leave 5 stars on Spotify. Really does help out the podcast. And again, don't forget, I will keep reminding you until the day comes that Google Podcast is being shut down at the beginning of April. So you will have to get your sound off some other way if you listen through Google Podcast. You don't got to worry, because there are plenty of ways to get the podcast, including directly through the free Spreaker app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora. There's a ton of different ways. So just FYI, if you are still using Google Podcasts, and that is not just for my show, that is for any show. They are shutting down the app. I believe April 2nd is the date, but better to find something now and start using it and getting used to it now. And again, here on St. Patrick's Day, I would be remiss if I did not plug the new Becky Lynch book that is out. Becky Lynch, The Man, Not Your Average Girl. Officially, it drops on March 26th. You can pre-order the book right now and get it for free when you use my Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. It is narrated by Becky herself. And if you are an Amazon Prime member, you get 2 free books. So go ahead and get yourself a free book, audibletrial.com/solomonster. We'll get to my Dark Side of the Ring review later on. This week it was on Buff Bagwell. And boy, do I got some stories for you if you did not see this episode. Holy shit, we'll get to that later. And a ton of AEW news and WWE news, which is what we're going to start off with here. The website, Front Office Sports, this week issued a report identifying the previously unidentified corporate officers that are referenced in the Janelle Grant sex trafficking lawsuit against WWE, Vince McMahon, and John Laurinaitis, which had led to a lot of speculation about who these people were and what they knew and when they knew it. Paul Levesque's name was thrown around online as one of the officers referenced without anyone actually having anything to back up that claim. His name was being thrown around for weeks, which is why I never mentioned it here. I think people were trying to will it into existence that he was one of them, but as it turns out, he is not one of them. And the reporters were able to do their own research. They also spoke with at least one source, probably somebody who works for WWE, to come up with the names, and then they got the 4 names confirmed, there are 4 of them, by Janelle Grant's attorney, and it's not good. It's not a good look at all for any of the people involved. We'll start with the first two. This is directly from the Front Office Sports story. WWE President Nick Khan and COO Brad Blum are the men identified as corporate officers number 1 and number 2 in a sex trafficking lawsuit filed in January in federal court in Connecticut. The suit claims that Khan and Blum, whose names have not previously been reported, were instrumental to a scheme in which the plaintiff, a woman named Janelle Grant, was employed in a completely undefined role except for the understanding that she remained a sexual slave to be used and trafficked by McMahon within WWE. Unlike McMahon and Laurinaitis, the two are not personally accused of sexual misconduct or violence. Rather, the suit claims that they and others facilitated and covered up exploitation in ways that make WWE liable under federal anti-trafficking law. Khan, a dealmaker and former CAA executive who earned a reputation as one of the most powerful men in sports media, through negotiating billion-dollar deals for clients like the SEC and WWE before joining them in 2020, is now the top person in control of the empire that it took McMahon a lifetime to build. You know, it is interesting how Vince McMahon, it took him decades to build WWE up to what it is today. It took Nick Khan all of, what, 3 years? 3.5 years to take over? He reports to Endeavor president Mark Shapiro and ultimately answers to legendary Hollywood power broker Ari Emanuel, who took over as the chair of WWE's parent company TKO after McMahon resigned in January following the suit filing. WWE takes Ms. Grant's allegations very seriously and has no tolerance for any physical abuse or unwanted physical contact, a WWE spokesperson said in a statement. Neither Nick Khan nor Brad Blum, prior to the lawsuit being filed, were aware of any allegation by Ms. Grant that she was the victim of abuse or unwanted physical contact, nor does the complaint allege that either had knowledge of such. I think the key word there is unwanted. Unwanted physical contact. So the implication being that they may have had knowledge of there being a relationship of some sort between the two, but not that there was any sort of abuse or criminal behavior involved. That sounds like their version of events. The story continues. The information about the identities of the corporate officers offers a new lens through which to view Ms. Grant's suit. Most attention is focused on the allegations of extreme sexual violence that the suit makes against McMahon and his associates. It can, though, also be read as a set of claims about how McMahon made the highest-ranking executives in his company complicit in his conduct. Front Office Sports independently identified Khan and Blum, as well as the other two anonymous corporate officers to whom the suit refers, by cross-checking the details of the suit against publicly available records like online resumes and corporate filings, as well as information provided by sources familiar with WWE. Corporate officer number one is said in the suit, for example, to have maintained a fourth-floor office in the company's former headquarters, which a person who worked there confirmed was true of Nick Khan. Front Office Sports then asked Grant's lawyer, Ann Callis, whether its reporting was accurate. I can confirm that these names are correct, she said. The suit says that McMahon groomed Grant while she was grieving the death of her parents and had her hired into a fake job with the company's legal department in May of 2019. Subsequent to that, it says she was subjected to extreme cruelty and degradation, including McMahon defecating on her during group sex, and he and Laurinaitis raping her in the WWE offices, with the abuse only ending in 2022. This left her, according to the suit, crippled both physically and mentally, including from debilitating symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and suicidal ideation. McMahon presented Blum and Khan to Grant as his key fixers, according to the suit. The first time McMahon met her, it says, in March of 2019, he promised Grant, who had minimal work history, that his office would reach out to arrange a meeting with Blum, who was executive vice president in charge of operations at the time. A week later, the suit says she met with Blum. He hardly asked any questions, and before long, she had been hired into a $75,000-a-year job in the legal department. In February of 2020, the suit says McMahon told Grant that Blum had warned him that there was a lot of rumors circulating about the relationship. Immediately after this, she was transferred to another department. Years later, after McMahon and Grant signed a non-disclosure agreement that he negotiated on WWE's behalf without its knowledge, the two had a call that he claimed would be the last conversation they would ever have, during which he named Blum as one of the two people she should call if she ever needed anything. The second of those two people was Khan. According to the suit, in March of 2021, Grant told McMahon that Khan had responded to her by introducing herself in a corridor by telling her that he knew exactly who she was. Later that day, the suit says McMahon told her that he had held a meeting with Khan and Blum and informed them of the nature of their relationship. McMahon told her, the suit says, that the two men had voiced concerns to him and inquired whether Grant could be trusted. A WWE spokesperson denies this conversation ever happened. McMahon told Grant that the two expressed concern but were ultimately supportive. The next day, the suit says Blum told her that she was being transferred to the talent relations department where she would report to Laurinaitis, with whom McMahon had months before pressured her into group sex at McMahon's condo. She was, going forward, the suit says, expected to sexually service Laurinaitis at his hotel and in his office. The suit alleges that her sexual exploitation continued for another year. It also says that during negotiations over the NDA, Grant included Khan and Blum in a list of people whose roles should be addressed in the agreement due to their knowledge of the relationship, although the suggestion was rejected. The person identified in the suit as corporate officer number 3 is, according to Front Office Sports, McMahon's daughter, longtime WWE executive Stephanie McMahon. She is mentioned once in an ambiguous context. Grant attended meetings of WWE's executive committee, something far above her pay grade, and the appropriateness of which she asked Khan and Blum about. At one of these meetings, the suit says Stephanie McMahon, who is described as knowing of other instances of Vince McMahon engaging in inappropriate sexual conduct, motioned Grant to sit near her. 3 months after the NDA between McMahon and Grant was signed in 2022, Stephanie, then WWE's chief brand officer, announced that she was taking a leave of absence from the company. A month later, the Wall Street Journal reported on a probe by the board of directors into payments made by McMahon involving NDAs with several former female employees and performers. After his subsequent resignation as CEO and chair, she became interim CEO and chair. In early 2023, her father seized control of the board ahead of their eventual merger with the UFC. Under the auspices of Endeavor, she resigned days later. Stephanie did not respond to questions sent via overnight letter to a post office box she is set to control and through a direct message to a social media account that she controls. WWE declined to provide contact information for a lawyer or representative through which Front Office Sports could reach her. And finally here, the person identified as corporate officer number 4, according to Front Office Sports, which Grant's lawyer has confirmed, is Brian Nurse, formerly general counsel and head of WWE's legal department. According to the suit, on May 9th, 2019, 8 months after he had been hired, he offered Grant a job 3 hours after having called her to discuss a legal role. The next day, the suit says Vince McMahon told her that he had ordered Nurse to offer Grant the job, and then McMahon sexually assaulted her for the first time, putting his hand down her pants without consent. Every time I read one of these stories about this whole situation, I feel like I have to take a shower. And so what we have here is the billionaire head of this company throwing his weight around and putting this woman in positions of power that she had no business being in, and using her to satisfy his depraved sexual desires, we'll put it that way. And so you have the other executives in the company, some of them at least, including his own daughter, clearly aware that something was going on, and they went along with it. Because Vince is all-powerful, and it was his company, and what Vince wants, Vince gets. Right? Nobody knows that more than his own daughter. There is no way that Stephanie McMahon was not aware years ago that her father was a fucking predator. There's no way. A predator and a creep. Even after the tanning salon incident years ago, she was said to be furious, absolutely livid about the whole thing, the day the cop showed up to question him about that incident. Because there was a writer's meeting going on that day. This is a story Chris DeJoseph has told. He was writing for WWE at the time, and they had all the writers down there at his condo, whatever it is, down there in Boca. And Stephanie was there, I think, and they were having this meeting to plan out, I think, the next year of storylines, and maybe half the meeting they got through before the cop showed up to question him about the tanning salon incident. And then the meeting was abruptly adjourned, and that was the end of the creative meeting. But she was furious about it. These are things that she was well aware of. She knows who her father is. And yet she still went out there, whether it was at her father's request or not, I don't care. She went out there on SmackDown after the first story came out in the Wall Street Journal about the NDAs and the hush money payments. She went out there to lead the crowd in chants of "Thank you, Vince." Which in the history of segments that we can look back on and say, boy, that didn't age well, is pretty fucking high up on the list. Now, when Vince forced his way back into the company, Stephanie bolted. She has not been back since. Because she knew. She knew the baggage that her father brought with him. She knew what he really was, and she did not want to have anything to do with it. She didn't want to work with him anymore. I honestly wonder how much contact she even allows him to have with his grandchildren at this point. Would you allow someone like that to be around your kids? She knows what he is. He's a monster. Now, there was no mention of Triple H in any of this, but he is married to Stephanie. He is married into that family. Is it possible that he had no knowledge of any of this or of who this woman was? Yes, it's possible. Do I personally believe that he had no knowledge of Vince cavorting around with female employees? No, I don't. And if his wife knew, then it's pretty likely that he knew too. That doesn't mean he knew about the abuse that was allegedly going on with him and Janelle Grant. Same with Stephanie. I don't know that Stephanie knew some of this depraved shit that was going on. But he knows who Vince is too. Triple H does. He's been around this man long enough to know exactly what he is. And there is a reason why, when the board of directors unanimously rejected the idea of Vince McMahon returning to the company, that was in late 2022, he was one of those voices that said no. He and his wife, both the man's own daughter and son-in-law, were on the board and they said no. You know who else was on the board? Nick Khan. They were all on the board when they voted unanimously to reject the idea of Vince coming back because they knew how damaging it could be to the company. And then when he made moves to force his way back in anyway, they all voted in favor of him, and that's when Stephanie walked away. That was very telling. So that's where things stand right now. I know this sort of thing happens at other companies where you'll have the CEO or the top executive sleeping around with people that work for them. There's a reason why many of these companies have a code of conduct that prohibits this sort of thing. And in a lot of cases, it's rules for thee, but not for me. They can do it, but if it was anybody else, right, they would be gone. WWE has a history of deplorable people working for them, going back decades. If you want to get into the Ring Boy scandal and the countless other horrible stories, this company has been dirty for decades. It was just part of the culture there. And it all started with one man. And now that man is on the outside looking in. He still has his 8% ownership stake, but he's on the outside looking in, and from Endeavor's point of view, he no longer works there. You heard Mark Shapiro last week when he was asked about Vince McMahon. He no longer comes into the office. He no longer is employed in this company. He will never again be employed by this company. And that's it. And that's their point of view. We may never know exactly what all of these people knew and when they knew it, not unless they come out and admit it. And maybe they'll have to, under oath at some point. But it makes them all look complicit in what is alleged to have gone on here, whether they were aware of all the gory details or not about what was going on behind closed doors. They have to live with that. They played a part in that, at least a small role in covering up what was going on. The question is, had they known exactly what was happening to this woman, would they still have stayed silent for the sake of their jobs and for the sake of the company, or would someone have had the spine to actually speak up? Maybe I don't want to know the answer to that question. Speaking of Triple H, this is the sort of thing I can get behind that I want to see more of. It was announced on Friday that WWE's own Shayna Baszler will be competing at Josh Barnett's Bloodsport show in Philadelphia on Thursday, April 4th. The show is being hosted by Josh Barnett and GCW, Game Changer Wrestling, as part of the Collective. Bloodsport, if you don't know, it's a wrestling show where matches can only be won by submission or knockout, which is perfect for Baszler because she's trained in MMA. She did MMA before she ever got into pro wrestling. Bloodsport, it combines elements of wrestling and MMA. And the show is airing live on Triller TV Plus, and WWE is allowing one of its contracted performers to work an indie show WrestleMania weekend. This is a major departure from anything that Vince McMahon ever would have allowed. Fightful Select says WWE sources confirmed to them that Barnett is the one who reached out to Triple H to secure Shayna for the show, and that Triple H and Barnett have known each other for many years and seem to have a great respect for each other. So it may be more a case of Triple H having respect for Barnett and doing it as a favor to him, but even still, I mean, it's a sign that he is more open to allowing talent to work outside shows. They've done it a handful of times in the past, either as a favor to someone or, you know, earlier this year, they sent Charlie Dempsey from NXT to All Japan to fight for the Triple Crown. Shinsuke Nakamura last year was allowed to wrestle the Great Muta in Pro Wrestling Noah. Muta was on his retirement tour and then he was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. But this would be a big change from the way they typically do business, especially if they allow her match to be broadcast live on Triller, instead of asking for it to be blacked out and shown only to the live audience. That does not appear to be the case as far as I can tell. That doesn't mean it won't happen, but as far as I can tell, it's part of the show and it's going to air. Baszler's opponent has not been named. She is just perfect, though, for Bloodsport, and she's good friends with Barnett. Barnett was the one who trained her in wrestling and MMA, and he's also the one who gave her the Queen of Spades nickname. Now, Fightful is reporting that multiple WWE stars are scheduled to compete at Bloodsport that day, so Baszler is not going to be the only one. She's the first name to be announced. Nick Nemeth against Speedball Mike Bailey, Josh Barnett against John Hennigan, and Minoru Suzuki against Royce Isaacs have already been announced for the show. We're going to have WWE talent working the same show as Minoru Suzuki. I wonder if it's a case where Triple H is going to let some of the people who are not on the WrestleMania card this year work Bloodsport, so they can at least have something to do, because I can't imagine anybody on the WrestleMania card is going to be allowed to work an indie show 2 days before and risk injury going into the pay-per-view. I'll tell you what, since it looks like he's out of luck for WrestleMania this year, get Chad Gable on that Bloodsport show. I think he would thrive. Yeah, WWE, I think this is great. I love this. And WWE has always been very averse to allowing their independent contractors to work independent shows. You know, they should be allowed to do so. As long as WWE has control over it and they secure the booking for them, you know, that could be the compromise there. Then I do think they should be more open to this sort of thing. That way they retain the power, but they allow the talent to work an outside date here and there if they want to. Or, you know, maybe if it's tied into a big weekend like WrestleMania or SummerSlam, where you have these indie shows that book dates around the WWE event, you know, in a given weekend. I don't see anything wrong with that, especially if we're talking about a talent that either is not being used on TV or is not being featured in any meaningful way. And Baszler has been on TV. In fact, she and Zoe Stark just challenged the Kabuki Warriors on Monday for the women's tag team titles, and they lost. But let's be honest, Shayna Baszler is not involved in anything that I would consider to be meaningful right now on WWE television. You know, we hear about this forbidden door, which is a phrase that Hiroshi Tanahashi coined a few years ago. He was talking about the possibility of challenging Chris Jericho for his AEW world title at the time. That's where the whole forbidden door thing first started. The real forbidden door has always been WWE. You know, they generally do not play well with others. They choose not to because they don't have to. It doesn't affect their business one way or the other. And even now, their business is as hot as it's been in years, and that's with the same people every week on TV. They don't need to bring people in from the outside or let their wrestlers work somewhere else and risk getting hurt or get involved in any political issues when it comes to winning and losing on someone else's show. They just don't bother with it. But they should. I think it would be fun for the fans. I think it would be great for the talent involved if they want to be able to work outside the WWE ecosystem. You know, work with people other than the same people they always work with. And if you're WWE, it can't hurt to cultivate a relationship with some of these promotions, you know, for selfish reasons when it comes to talent scouting. Because when it comes to WWE, I feel like there's always an ulterior motive involved, right? Or some kind of selfish reason for doing what they do. How can this help our business? And that's not even necessarily a bad thing, right? If I were running a business, that'd be the first question I would ask. Why should I do this? How is this going to benefit my business, right? Perfectly logical question. But when I first heard about this, I thought, what are they up to? Right? They're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart. Even if Triple H is friendly with Josh Barnett, right? It's never out of the goodness of their heart. What is their motivation here? But I think it's very cool for the fans. You know, and I think about other talents, and we'll see this week if new names get announced, but I was thinking of people who are not being used right now in WWE. You have someone like Apollo Crews, who's not being used. I think he's on main event duty. And he was a big deal on the independents once upon a time, right? Azuha Nation. Why not use him on a show like that? The Creed brothers in Bloodsport, right? What a great fit. If they're not going to make WrestleMania, then at least they can still be a part of the festivities that weekend. I hope we get to see more of this.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet. Keep up the great work, Solid Monster. I've been a fan for years, and thank you for letting me hop in here for just a few seconds to tell you about my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. Earlier this week, I had the first interview with former WWE superstars Emma and Madcap Moss since they were released from WWE last year. We talk about their recent wedding. Congrats to them. We also talk about what's next for them since they were released. Also, go check out some of my interviews like the one I did with John Cena or Chelsea Green, Roderick Strong, LA Knight, Bobby Roode, and so many others. You can find my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this one right now.
We got a couple more names confirmed for this year's WWE Hall of Fame class, with another rumored name likely. On Monday, WWE announced that one of the greatest boxers of all time, an Olympic gold medalist, this man is an icon, and he had some involvement in pro wrestling too, Muhammad Ali, will be inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. Ali is a no-brainer as a celebrity inductee. I don't know how it took this long for him to even go in. But they already announced the U.S. Express going in. They were on that first WrestleMania at Madison Square Garden, and so is Ali. So it looks like they're tying into the 40th anniversary theme, even though it's not really the 40th anniversary. That would be next year, since there was no WrestleMania Zero. But those charismatic promos that made him such a big star sound like pro wrestling promos when you go back and watch them. And there's good reason for that, because they were inspired by pro wrestling. He was a pro wrestling fan. And specifically, they were inspired by Fred Blassie. In fact, when Ali came in to work an angle for WWE in 1976, they had Blassie with him as his manager. Yeah, he did an angle on TV where he confronted Gorilla Monsoon, and Monsoon got him up in an airplane spin and then dropped him. Ali was selling his ass off. I mean, you could tell this man was a wrestling fan. And then after, Monsoon with the classic line that Ali wouldn't know a wrist lock from a wristwatch. Ali was the heavyweight champion at that time. This was after he beat George Foreman for the title. So he's doing this. It's not like he's some no-name guy. He's one of the most famous names in the world at that point. And that was only a few weeks before his infamous match with Antonio Inoki in Japan. What is considered by many to be the first mixed martial arts match. The most boring fight you will ever see. There was so much politicking involved. It was a shoot fight, but the rules heavily favored Ali. Inoki couldn't do anything with him. He couldn't wrestle him. He couldn't grapple him. So what Inoki did was he laid down on his back and he kicked at Ali's legs anytime he got close to him. And he did so much damage that Ali ended up with blood clots in both of his legs, and it almost ended his career. Just a total disaster this was. But then you forward to 1985, and there were actually two separate occasions that year where he got to play the role of ringside enforcer. The first WrestleMania main event, he was ringside for Hulk Hogan and Mr. T against Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff. He was originally supposed to be the guest referee in the ring, but they realized that this is going to be a mess if we put him in there. So they made Pat Patterson the referee, and Ali stood on the outside. And that made sense because, if Mr. T got lost, he's not a wrestler, right? If he gets lost, Patterson could guide him and tell him what to do. But then later that same year, this is actually only a few months later, maybe 3 months later, Ali ends up at the Superdome in New Orleans at a Mid-South wrestling show. And I talked about this in my Tales from the Territories review on Mid-South. Jake Roberts talked about his run-in with Ali. It was Jake against the Snowman. And I'm sure there were plenty of snowmen in wrestling back in the 80s, and Jake probably knew most of them. But on this night, Ali was in there as backup for the Snowman. And at one point during the match, Ali got up on the apron. Actually, it was towards the finish. Ali got up on the apron, and he started throwing haymakers. And Jake is taking these shots. He's taken these punches from Muhammad Ali but he's not going down. He took like three of them. And Jake is just sort of staggering around. And when Jake got to the back, Bill Watts was furious with him for not selling for Ali. And Jake's argument was, I've got to come back here to work tomorrow. He doesn't. And Jake claims that Ali came up to him in the locker room. He didn't know if he was going to be mad or not. And Ali comes over and he whispers to Jake, he goes, smart man. Basically, Ali got it. He got that Jake has to work in front of these same people again. He doesn't. That's the story that Jake tells. But yeah, both those things happened in the same year. The other name announced for the Hall of Fame was Thunderbolt Patterson, who never actually worked for WWE. But, you know, for a Hall of Fame that has welcomed a lot of people that did not work for WWE or had a very quick run in WWE, he is certainly a name that is worthy of induction. He was blacklisted from many promotions for complaining about the treatment of wrestlers, especially black wrestlers back then. He tried to get wrestling regulated by state governments the way that they regulate sports like boxing. That didn't win him many fans with the promoters. But he worked tons of NWA territories. He was tag team champion in Mid-Atlantic with Gerald Briscoe and with Ole Anderson in Georgia Championship Wrestling. There's a great story, actually, that he and Briscoe told last year on the podcast that Briscoe does with JBL. And I love the fact that there was a Patterson and Briscoe before the Patterson and Briscoe that we all saw on WWE television in the late 90s. Like, you say Patterson and Briscoe, you think of Pat Patterson. But before Pat, it was Thunderbolt Patterson and Jerry Briscoe. And they told the story of when James Brown offered his private jet to them so they could get to their next show. And they turned him down. So what happened was, Patterson and Briscoe, they were on their way to a show somewhere, I don't remember where, and they got pulled over by the cops. Thunderbolt had just bought a brand new Cadillac. He had a Cadillac Eldorado. And the cops asked him for his registration. Well, he didn't have any. He drove the car right off the lot. It still had the paper tags on it. So the cops assumed the car must be stolen. And so they threw him in jail. So they got one of the bookers out there to bail them out. They're at the airport. And James Brown flies in on his jet. Now, apparently he knew who Thunderbolt Patterson was. He saw him and he offered his jet to both of them so they could get to their next show. And then his pilot would fly back and would pick him up and would take him to wherever he was going to go next. And they turned him down because they already had a plane waiting for them from the booker who bailed them out. And Briscoe said it was the biggest mistake they ever made, saying no to James Brown. But, you know, his promo style, It was imitated by, and the great thing about YouTube is that you can just go on there and bring up almost anything. Now, I didn't grow up watching Thunderbolt Patterson. If you would have said to a young Solomonster, do you know who Thunderbolt Patterson was? I would say, no, I don't watch that cartoon. How the fuck am I supposed to know who this guy is? I live in the Northeast. I'm watching WWE when I'm fucking 8 years old. I don't know who Thunderbolt Patterson is. But the great thing about YouTube is that you can go back and you can watch promos and matches from almost anybody. And so years ago, I became familiar with Thunderbolt Patterson. And you cannot watch a Thunderbolt Patterson promo and not hear Dusty Rhodes. It's so obvious that Dusty Rhodes, he imitated Thunderbolt Patterson. Thunderbolt Patterson used to say things like, we're going to get funky, right? And so, of course, Dusty would come out years later and talk about getting funky, right? Getting funky like a monkey. It's clear where he got that from. He took things actually from Patterson and from superstar Billy Graham. So did Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan took a lot from superstar Billy Graham. So you can't say that Patterson was not an influential figure in the wrestling business. He absolutely was. The third name, which is not yet confirmed, this has not been announced by WWE, although it might be by the time you listen to this. Meltzer says it is happening that The Rock's grandmother, Leah Maivia, will be inducted as part of the class of 2024. And very likely will be inducted by her grandson, because The Rock also inducted her husband, the High Chief Peter Maivia, and his father, Rocky Johnson, in the same year. They both went in 2008. Actually, his grandmother was there for that Hall of Fame in 2008, but I think she died later that same year. She died of a heart attack. When Peter Maivia died of cancer in 1982, Leah Maivia took over as the promoter for Polynesian Pro Wrestling out of Hawaii. And basically ran it until the promotion closed many years later. She was not the first female promoter in wrestling, even though the Tales from the Territories episode tried to portray it like she was. But she would be considered one of the first female promoters in wrestling. She was also arrested and accused of extortion at one point by her former announcer, who got the FBI involved. It was like an FBI sting. Money was exchanged. FBI agents swooped in. They arrested her. That was a whole story I've talked about before. But she was put on trial. Ultimately, the jury found her not guilty. I think they deported her after that. The funny thing, though, about that Hall of Fame ceremony in 2008, now that I think about it, was that they had Liam Iavia. She was sitting in the front row, but she was seated right next to Shawn Michaels and his wife at the Hall of Fame that year. And the reason there was heat for so many years, or one of the reasons, between Rock and Shawn Michaels, and primarily it was really from the Rock's end. I don't know that Shawn had heat, you know, like he was angry at the Rock or anything. Although there were plenty of stories about him and Triple H politically trying to sabotage him when he was getting over in the late 90s. But the reason there was so much anger there from Rock's side toward Shawn Michaels was because when Rock was a teenager, Michaels came to the island for a wrestling show for Polynesian Pro. I guess he was booked. And he said something very disrespectful to the Rock's grandmother. And I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, it pissed off the Rock so badly. He and Shawn almost came to blows. He wanted to fight him. And so I'm thinking back to the 2008 Hall of Fame, and there she was, all those years later, with Shawn sitting right there next to her. And it made me think of, boy, there's a lot of history behind that. There's a lot of history. I think that was the Hall of Fame where Rock and Shawn finally spoke, I think, and made amends. Because for a while there, like in the mid-2000s, I remember there was one time at least, Rock was asked about not wrestling Shawn Michaels. And he said at the time he never had any interest. I never had any interest in wrestling Shawn Michaels. Now, if you ask that question, I think he has said, oh, you know, yeah, I wish I would have had the chance to wrestle Shawn Michaels. So it was pretty clear that up until that 2008 Hall of Fame, there was still some ill feelings there. But I know there was a list floating around on Reddit weeks ago with all the Hall of Fame names on it. Most of them have since been proven to be true. Wherever that list came from, obviously it was very accurate. Liam Iavia was one of the names on that list, and so was Bray Wyatt. And those are the only two names that have not been made official yet. I figured they were saving Bray for last. So unless something has changed, I'm expecting those to be the final two names announced, not counting the Warrior Award, if they give that out this year. Last year, they gave that honor to referee Tim White. I don't know who's going to get it this year. I'll tell you one thing, though. We need more referees in the Hall of Fame. That's what we need. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. You ever go to the casino and only play the slot machines? Why only play the slots? You know, the big money is in all the other games. Why would you limit yourself like that? Well, watching Netflix without ExpressVPN is basically the same thing. Why limit yourself to only a fraction of the shows and movies that you can watch when you can use ExpressVPN and unlock so many hours of new content? It's true. Netflix has different content libraries for every country, but without a VPN, you're not getting the most bang for your buck. That's why you need ExpressVPN. It lets you change your location online to make Netflix think you live in one place when in reality you're in a totally different place. With ExpressVPN, I've been watching episodes of The Office. And if you're a fan of The Office, you may not realize that you can't watch it anymore on Netflix in the US. It's not there. So in order to watch Michael and Dwight, I just opened the ExpressVPN app. I selected Canada as my country. I became an honorary Canadian. I didn't even need to file any visa paperwork to do it. I tapped one button to connect, and just like that, when I refreshed the page on Netflix, there it was. You realize how easy that was? You've got people sitting there banging their head against the wall when they realize they can't watch the show, when all they had to do was go the VPN route. In a lot of cases, they just don't realize that it's even an option for them. Some of the things I love about ExpressVPN and why I use it are the super fast speeds, it's very fast, and how many different devices it works on. I can use it on my laptop, I can use it on my smartphone, I can use it on my smart TV. So I always have access wherever I am. They make it all very convenient. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Again, that's expressvpn.com/solomonster. The Rock was back on SmackDown this week with a pretty badass Hollywood Rock remix. I was hoping that at WrestleMania we might hear Hollywood Rock when he walked out there, but he actually brought it back on SmackDown this week. He started with his normal theme song, and then there's a little bit of a new intro added. There's a quick switch to the Hollywood Rock theme, and I didn't hear it initially on Friday, but when I went back and watched it again, he also spliced in part of his old, like, late 90s theme. So I thought that was pretty cool. But he came out, and he did a rock concert. He was in Memphis, which used to be his home when he was first breaking into the business for many years there. He lived in Memphis. He wrestled as Flex Cavana. He talked about Flex. This year's WrestleMania, if you think about it, was supposed to be Cody Rhodes against Roman Reigns. Right? And Cody won the Royal Rumble. Then it was going to be The Rock against Roman Reigns because Cody stepped aside. And we're going to get Rock and Roman. And the fans didn't like that. And it forced a change in direction. Rock decided he was going to go tweener. He was going to go heel. And now we're back to Cody and Roman. So we are getting that match after all. But now here we are a few weeks out from WrestleMania. And The Rock is basically in a position where he has taken this entire show over on both nights. And they have made WrestleMania 40 all about The Rock. He has managed to make both main events all about himself this year. We have Rock getting back in the ring to tag with Roman on night one against Cody and Seth. And we have on night two a situation where you know The Rock is going to be involved. And The Rock was on television on Friday night teasing a confrontation of sorts, not with Cody, but with Mama Rhodes. We have gone from Cody and Roman to Rock and Roman, back to Cody and Roman, and now Rock against Cody's mom. It's amazing. Now, he was also out there on Friday night. He was mocking Cody, as he was in his social media promo earlier in the day, mocking Cody for crying in the ring on Monday night. Cody was sitting there doing an interview on Monday with Michael Cole, and he started getting emotional, and he started to cry when he talked about how I can't present the title to my dad, but I can present it to my mom. And The Rock absolutely just eviscerated him for this. Now, it was designed that way for Cody to go out there and cry and be emotional, so that way we have Cody crying on Raw, and it gives Rock material to go out there and throw back at him to make fun of him for it on SmackDown. I'm sure it was all laid out that way. The problem is, all that does is make Cody, your number one contender for your top title, in your WrestleMania main event for the second straight year, it makes him look uncool by comparison. I didn't mind the emotion so much on Monday, but when I saw The Rock tearing him up on Friday, I said, boy, this is not a good look for Cody. And so now Cody Rhodes needs to show up in a big way tomorrow night. He needs to throw it right back in The Rock's face. You cannot have Cody Rhodes go out there on television last week or the week before, whatever it was. He went out there, he looked dead in the camera on Raw, and he threatened The Rock. Like, he had a serious look in his eyes, and he threatened The Rock for talking shit about his dog. Right? Like, bringing up Pharaoh, that's one step too far. You can't have Cody go out there and threaten The Rock for talking about his dog and then not have him come out and get hot at The Rock for talking about his mother. So they need to let Cody take the kid gloves off tomorrow. You know, Cody's not going to go out there and get down in the gutter like Rock does with some of his insults. That's not what Cody's character does. He's the PG hero. But that doesn't mean that he can't take some stiff shots at The Rock. He needs to take those shots at him. The closest thing that we have had so far was Seth Rollins calling The Rock Mr. Midlife Crisis, which I thought was a good jab. We need more of that. That's the only time that either one of them have really hit Rock below the belt in this feud so far. But there's an issue here. There was a report from Aaron Varbles on SEScoops.com, and it had to do with talent frustration within WWE over Rock not playing by the same rules that everybody else is supposed to play by. And this is from his report. The Rock is back in WWE and having a great time as a heel. It also seems that the rules don't apply to him. I can exclusively report that a recent memo emphasized the need for talent to follow PG guidelines on TV and social media. Despite this, The Rock's use of profanity, like in a recent promo, has raised questions among talent about double standards. They wonder why he is allowed to curse while others aren't. I'm told that Nick Khan, Paul Levesque, and Dan Ventrell, that is the EVP of talent, recently sent out a memo about talent needing to adhere to PG guidelines on TV and on social media. That being said, there seems to be an exception that is getting under some talent's skin. I was told The Rock's viral promos, where he keeps cursing, have rubbed some people the wrong way. There seems to be a feeling that we are seeing a double standard. Yeah, no shit. It seems that The Rock is able to get away with dropping every flowery profanity he wants to on social media while the rest of the roster are wearing PG handcuffs. I was additionally told that talent are asking why The Rock is getting a pass. I was told that the thinking is that even if he is the big movie star, shouldn't everyone play by the same rules? So he can curse and use that to get over, but everybody else is handcuffed. Now this morning, before I went and started recording here, The Rock posted on Instagram, and he seemed to indirectly address this report without denying it. He said, "Networks and standards and practices have issues with my language, but I would rather be real than not. I talk from the heart, shoot from the hip, and try to always have fun." And then he linked to a clip from the Rock concert on Friday night. So here's the thing about this report. If this report is accurate, here's the thing about this, okay? First of all, it's The Rock. He is one of the biggest stars of all time. He does not play by the same rules as everybody else. It is no different than if Stone Cold Steve Austin came back and he was dropping profanity-laced tirades on people. And if I remember correctly, when Austin did come back a couple of years ago and he was out in the desert, remember that video they sent in? Because he was never on TV. But he was out in the desert somewhere, probably in Nevada where he lives, and he got outside of his car, he cut a promo on Kevin Owens, and I think he dropped some profanity in the promo, because he's Stone Cold Steve Austin. And if you bring back Stone Cold Steve Austin, I don't care if the little box in the corner says PG, the man is going to cuss. And The Rock is no different. Rock was doing the same thing with John Cena. But Cena had the leeway to give it right back to him. You know, unlike Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins, John Cena also came up in WWE at a time where he was allowed to be very non-PG. And when you look back on those segments with Rock and Cena from 2012, John Cena outclassed him. Like, Rock would give it to him, and then Cena would give it right back, and Rock would get hot about it, especially the crib notes on the wrist, which I know Cena now says he regrets, and it was unprofessional. Because Rock didn't know it was coming, but you could see The Rock, he was seething over that. But week after week, Cena would give it right back to him, and it felt like more of a fair fight. This does not feel like a fair fight. If Cody and Seth are handcuffed like the rest of the roster, and I don't know if they are or not, it sure seems like they are. Rock is going out there, and he's going on social media, he's tearing them apart. And so far, Cody nor Seth have had any answer for it. That has to change. If there are people on the roster upset that Rock is not playing by the same rules that they are, look, I get the frustration, but it's The Rock. And there are exceptions that are made for bigger stars. That's always been the case, whether you feel it's fair or not. They're fortunate that they have The Rock back, and The Rock is back on television. He hasn't been on television this much in years. They're not going to tell The Rock, oh, you can't do this and you can't do that. You know, other than, hey, you can't drop an F-bomb on TV. They pretty much let him go out there and do what he wants. And here's the other thing. The Rock is on the board of directors now. I mean, he may not be their boss. That might just be the storyline. But he is on the board of directors. You know, he's got his own writer in there with him. He's got Brian Gewirtz back with him. He doesn't have to play by the same rules. He operates in his own world. But the people that Rock is working with right now, they should at least be able to operate under those same rules. Maybe he doesn't want that. Maybe it's an ego thing. Maybe he still remembers the Cena feud. I don't know. But Cody, at least, more than Seth. Seth is just an add-on here. Seth is a clinger. He's not the one feuding with The Rock. Cody is. You know who else, by the way, feels like an add-on here and a clinger and all this? Roman Reigns. He and Seth have something in common, like they're just along for the ride. But Cody is the man challenging for the title in the main event of Night 2. This is his story, and he is in jeopardy of being upstaged in his own story if he does not go out there and show people why they should view him as being one of Rock's equals. And I'm not even saying that he is Rock's equal. Not on the mic, he's not. Very few people are. But it's all about perception. He needs to try to at least pretend that he is on the same level. The gloves need to come off. Throw Black Adam in his face. Something, anything. Or is Rock's ego such that he won't allow for that to happen? Now you go back to Raw Monday night, other than Cody crying, there was something else that happened on the show. There was a gauntlet match to crown a number one contender for Gunther in the Intercontinental title of WrestleMania. And it came down to the two favorites. It came down to the only two realistic options, Sami Zayn and Chad Gable. And I said going in, I was rooting for Chad Gable. My head was telling me Sami Zayn, based on how the storyline was going on TV with Sami cutting all these promos for weeks and weeks and weeks, and the fact that he had no other obvious match and they were not going to leave Sami Zayn off the WrestleMania card. So my head was saying it's probably going to be Sami. My heart was saying, boy, I hope it's Chad Gable, because he's got his own really great story. And they even had a little video package for him earlier in the show that was really good. And he mentioned his daughter and the last time he and Gunther were in the ring together. And I was hoping against hope that Gable would pull it off in the end. And he didn't. And Sami Zayn won. Now, Gable's shoulders were up off the mat, at least one of them. I don't think that that was on purpose. I don't think that's going to factor into the story. I don't think they're going to turn it into a triple threat. But his shoulders were up, technically. But then when the match was over, there was a lot of mixed opinion online. Some people just don't like Chad Gable. They don't think he's worthy of the spot, and they were very happy to see Sami Zayn win. Other people, it's not that they hate Sami, it's that they were very upset because they thought they had a cool story there with Chad Gable, and it would have been a huge spot for him at WrestleMania, and they screwed the pooch on it. On his podcast, on his Hall of Fame podcast with his co-host Brad Gilmore, Booker T commented on Sami Zayn winning in the gauntlet match. He said, I talked to Sami Zayn actually on Tuesday morning. We were flying to Orlando and we were sitting next to each other on the plane. And I swear, the same thing like you just said, so many people were pulling for Chad Gable in that match. And Sami, I said, man, you know what? What a match. I said, what a match. You're going to look back on this one day and say that was the one. That was the one that catapulted me to the next. I don't know what he's talking about here because Sami Zayn was in the main event of WrestleMania last year. I don't know what next level Booker is talking about here, but he's putting over Sami. He's putting over Sami. He's putting over the match. And he claims that Sami was so upset about the online heat that he got from the fans. He said, he's like, man, I thought the fans loved me. And then the next thing you know, I see all this stuff. And I told him, man, you can't listen to that white noise. You got to think about how great that match was. And you're going to look back on it one day and say, man, that was some really good work that I did. But he was still feeling the heat. He let someone down just because the fans didn't think the match was as good as I thought it was. It's not a matter of people disliking Sami Zayn. And I would hope he understands that. I mean, Sami he's been in the business for so long and he's been part of this game for so long. I would certainly hope he understands that there's a distinction to be made here. Sami Zayn is one of the top babyfaces in the entire company. His storyline with the Bloodline cemented that. Okay, a year ago, he was challenging Roman Reigns for the Undisputed title in his hometown, headlining the Elimination Chamber. And then, even though he lost, he went on to headline Night 1 of WrestleMania. He won the tag team titles with Kevin Owens, right? The Usos, 600 plus days as tag team champions, ended by Sami and KO. He got the glory. He may not have won the world title yet. He will. But he got a great payoff at WrestleMania last year. He was in one of the main events. No longer was Sami Zayn the underdog. No longer was he the underutilized one or the overlooked one. He made it. Fast forward to today, and Chad Gable is in that same spot. Now he's the underutilized one. He's the one who people overlook. He's the one with the story, with Gunther, telling him that you can't do it. You can't beat me. You're not good enough. You're a terrible father. You'll never make it. Sami got his moment last year. Now people wanted to see Gable get his, but that was taken from him. And they're back to telling the underdog story with Sami Zayn. I could have bought that if they would have stuck to him going after the world title. But along the way, as WrestleMania plans shifted and Brock Lesnar got pulled, and so that was the end of Gunther's opponent, whatever they had planned for Sami changed. I feel like had Punk not gotten hurt, it would have been Sami against Drew McIntyre, non-title, on the undercard of WrestleMania. With Sami trying to go in there and beat the one guy that he couldn't beat. I think that's what he would have done. And even after Punk got hurt, I feel like the plan was probably to take Sami and insert him into the world title match and make it a triple threat. And then that changed with the whole Rock situation. And they had no spot for Sami Zayn. And like I said, they're not going to leave him off the WrestleMania card a year after he just headlined the fucking show. So he got the spot against Gunther. But he is back to challenging for the same title that he has held before, with the story being, I need to be a champion again. I need to do something historic. I need to be the man to beat Gunther. But it doesn't work as well as the true underdog story. And it's hard to buy Sami Zayn as the underdog after all that this guy has accomplished. That's where a lot of the fan sentiment, a lot of the resentment is coming from. It has nothing to do with people no longer liking Sami Zayn. But I will say, if the plan is for Gunther to retain at WrestleMania, then it probably is for the best that things ended up the way they did, because Gable cannot afford to go in there and lose to Gunther for the fourth time? If they were going to do Gable and Gunther at WrestleMania, Gable would have to win. And if they're not prepared to beat Gunther yet and take that title off of him, if that is the plan, if that is the finish, then it's better off that Chad Gable not be in that match. But I still felt, and I still feel, that the better story for Sami Zayn, for him and Gunther, is for Sami to be coming after him, not for the Intercontinental title. He should be coming after him a year from now, at WrestleMania next year, for the World Heavyweight title. That's the story for Sami Zayn. And so him going after this guy for the IC title, it doesn't pack the same punch. Because at this point, for all that Sami has done, the only thing left for him to really achieve, yeah, it'd be cool for him to say, I'm the guy that beat Gunther. But honestly, it's all about him winning the World Heavyweight title. That's going to be his story going forward. Chad Gable had his, and because of the position they put Sami in, he became the one to take that away from Chad. That's why he's getting some heat and some blowback from the fans. It has nothing to do with people disliking Sami Zayn. I would certainly hope he understands that. Some other WWE news and notes. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reported on Wednesday that Minnesota Sports and Events has submitted its bid to host next year's WrestleMania at U.S. Bank Stadium, which is the home of the Minnesota Vikings. Wendy Blackshaw, their president and CEO, told the newspaper that the process was very competitive, but they are hopeful that they will end up getting it. And according to Minnesota Sports and Events, the economic impact of last year's WrestleMania in Los Angeles was right around $235 million. In comparison, the men's Final Four there generated $145 million. So it sounds like they're one of the finalists. We should know in the next probably couple of weeks, because by the time we get to WrestleMania 40, they're going to have to make the announcement about where WrestleMania 41 is. And The Undertaker, during a Patreon Q&A for his 6 Feet Under with Mark Calloway podcast, was asked about how he has handled the transition into retirement. He said, retirement is something that leaves a void in you. It's still tough for me. I'm still coming to grips with it. And I may or may not have said to my wife recently that I was going to make a comeback. Fortunately, I think I've talked myself out of that. You know, good Lord. Nobody is asking for that. When his co-host told him not to start any rumors, Undertaker confirmed that there will not be one more match. He says, no, there will not be one more. I just got back from Australia. I was tired. I knew I had a lot of stuff coming up. And that was just me feeling comfortable saying it. Don't expect it. There's not one more match. Don't even start. Well, I mean, if Sting hadn't retired, maybe. He ruined the whole thing. I got new knees and he went and had to go retire. Now, clearly he was joking, but I could just picture Sting punching air as he reads those comments. Like, dude, what the fuck? Because Sting has wanted that match for years. I mean, he wouldn't shut up about it for a while. All he was talking about was how much he wanted to do a match with The Undertaker. And he even pitched it to Vince McMahon as a cinematic match. And he wasn't interested. I think a cinematic match with Undertaker and Sting could have been a lot of fun. It would have been better than nothing. But that ship has sailed. Now let's talk about AEW here, because Darby Allin was supposed to be leaving in 10 days to go climb Mount Everest, maybe one of the last things he would have ever done, and fate intervened. This is actually amazing, because Darby had a match at Big Business on Wednesday with Switchblade Jay White, and they shot an angle at the end of that match, after the match, where Bullet Club Gold broke Darby's ankle. They wrapped a chair around his ankle, and they smashed the chair, and Darby had to be, you know, taken out, and he was hurt. Storyline injured. That was going to be his write-off, to send him into the trip to Everest, and maybe we'd see him again in a few months. As it turned out, TMZ Sports reported that Darby's trip to Mount Everest has been postponed because he broke three bones in his foot right before he was slated to make the climb, and it happened 2 minutes into the match with Jay White on Wednesday night. He attempted a front flip off the top rope. He did a dive, basically. He climbed up to the top rope 2 minutes into this match, and he did a cannonball dive out to the floor. Now, you go back and watch it, and I guess it's the way his feet were planted, but you don't watch it and go, oh man, that looks nasty. Like, it's hard to tell. Like, nobody could tell on Wednesday. There was nobody going, oh my God, it looked like Darby broke his foot. And he continued the rest of the match, and nobody was any the wiser about it, but that's where it happened. And he continued the match for about 10 more minutes, and he was doing all of his usual stuff on a broken foot. Darby himself tweeted, he said, unfortunately, the foot really is broken from Wednesday's match. Everest will have to wait until next year. And he posted a photo of his foot in a cast and of the x-ray of his broken foot. And so Darby Allin is not going to be climbing any mountains this year, and that is for the better. He trained for 6 months, and everything that I have seen written and reported about this, and anybody who has tried to climb Mount Everest or has done serious mountain climbing before thinks that this guy is out of his fucking mind for wanting to dive into a Mount Everest climb with only 6 months of climbing experience under his belt. There are people who die up there. That is a real thing. There are bodies that litter Mount Everest from people who are, I'm sure, far more experienced than Darby Allin. And it's a very serious thing. And I'm not saying he wasn't taking it seriously, but the level of experience that he had going into it put him in great danger. And I think that this is a sign. It is a sign from above. It is a sign from somewhere. Maybe it's a sign from Sting. But it is a sign that this is how it is supposed to be. Darby is not supposed to climb this mountain this year. I do believe that. Now, he's going to try again next year. But you know what? If he wants to try again next year, he'll have more time to climb other mountains and get some more experience under his belt if he really wants to do it. But for the time being, he's going to be out for a while. I don't know how long. It could be several weeks. It could be a few months. Knowing him, he'll be back on TV in 2 months. But that is the end of his Everest ambitions for this year. But that wasn't the only TMZ story concerning AEW. That was not the only AEW news that TMZ broke this week. Miro and Lana have split up after 7 years of marriage. They broke the news on Monday that CJ Perry and Miro have called it quits on their marriage 7 years after tying the knot. TMZ Sports has learned the famous, now former couple, who also play a married couple in the ring, broke up once and for all in the winter of 2023 after years of an on-again, off-again relationship. The couple said their I do's in July of 2016, a couple of years after they began dating. We reached out to Perry, and she confirmed the split. She said, Miro and I have made the difficult decision to separate after many wonderful years together and have decided to move on as friends and hopefully on-screen characters somewhere down the road. As for what went wrong, our sources say that there was not an explosive fight or cheating. They simply grew apart over the years. In fact, we're told that Perry and Miro remain friends and still plan to work together in the future. Neither Perry nor Miro have yet filed for divorce. Miro moved back to Bulgaria shortly after the couple called it quits. So they were working together in that match that Miro had with Andrade at World's End and had already split up by that point, because World's End was at the very end of the month, and that would explain where Miro has been. He's been back in Bulgaria. He claimed he was hurt. Maybe that was just a cover excuse, but that's too bad. You know, look, at least they're still friends, and they can work together. Randy Savage and Elizabeth, they got divorced, and they still work together. In WCW, she even managed him for a while. Mercedes Moné, in the worst kept secret in wrestling, made her surprise debut. On AEW Dynamite, their big business episode from Boston on Wednesday night, she came out. Of course, her hometown got a tremendous reaction. She's calling herself the CEO. It said she has a necklace that says CEO. It said CEO on her robe. It says it on her Tron. It's in her music. She is the CEO. She thanked fans for sticking with her and for believing in her. And she talked about how much pro wrestling means to her. We got an Eddie Guerrero reference, so drink. The crowd in her hometown, they treated her like a major star. Now they need to hope that that continues in other cities where she wasn't born or she didn't grow up. Hopefully that'll be the case when they go elsewhere. She'll get these superstar reactions. You know, they had her come back out at the end of the show to make the save for Willow Nightingale, who was the last woman that she was in the ring with when she was injured. And as it turns out, that leg injury was a lot more serious than anyone knew. She was interviewed by Sports Illustrated and said, "I got an MRI in May, and the surgeon told me this is career ending. That was the biggest shock in my whole life. I'd never really been injured like this before. My worst injury before this was from Hell in a Cell in 2019 when my pelvis was out of place for 8 months. This was so much more painful. People thought it was just a broken ankle. I was non-weight-bearing for 3 months. It was a fight every day. It was devastating when I was told I was never going to come back. But I always knew that I would be back, and I told that to my surgeon. Now I'm healthy, and my surgeon is calling his mentor, saying, 'Look at what happened here. It's incredible.' I don't like being told no. I've always believed I would be back, and now it's true." Now, in her promo on Wednesday, she talked about going global. She talked about this being a global revolution. She said the same thing in the interview with Sports Illustrated. She says, "It's a global revolution. That's why I'm here. You don't think I can't take this around the globe? Well, then let me show you I can. My heart is here. My dreams are here. I love wrestling. I'm a leader. And I am going to lead." And there were some people mocking the global reference after her promo on Wednesday. Like, you know, you come from WWE. It's the most global wrestling company in the world. But of course, these people probably only use 20% of their brain power. So what they did not really think about is the idea that when she's talking about global, she's talking about the ability to work in a lot of different places and spread the message of AEW. And now she's, you know, under contract. She has been for 2 months. She's under contract to AEW. She's waving the AEW flag. And wherever this woman goes now, whether it's to Mexico, whether it's to Japan, or anywhere else in the world, the UK, it's, you know, whatever it may be, she is representing AEW. And she is representing the AEW women's division. So she's not only going to wrestle for them. I could see her wrestling in Mexico for CMLL. Because AEW has a working relationship with CMLL. And I could see her working Stardom again. Because they still have the working agreement with New Japan and Bushiroad. And with Stardom, who is under new leadership now. In fact, the new president of Stardom was there in Boston on Wednesday. So there was more than one Okada in the TD Garden on Wednesday night. We had Mina Shirakawa of Stardom. She wrestled Anna Jay in a match that was taped for an upcoming episode of Ring of Honor. And Meltzer is reporting that CMLL and Stardom will be a part of this year's Forbidden Door show. So I fully expect to see Mercedes back in Stardom at some point. You know, a match here or there. Maybe she'll wrestle a Stardom talent on that Forbidden Door show. But that's what she was referring to when she was talking about going global. Now also, Meltzer said that she had negotiated with WWE in late 2022, which we knew, and then again in late 2023. And both times, according to the WWE side, she wanted more money than they were willing to offer. Supposedly, she wanted Becky Lynch-level money. And he says, while it is not clear what Tony Khan's offer was, those with knowledge of the offer said it was very substantial, obviously higher than WWE, but considerably lower than the $5 million per year that was going around. Some people were saying $5 million. Apparently that's bullshit. One WWE female star noted to The Observer that they were hearing that the number was enough to make her the highest paid woman in pro wrestling, and that they were thrilled at AEW for making the offer and happy for her to have accepted it, because in the long run, it means it's a better market for the top women wrestlers. And this talent noted that, "I think it sets a standard that a woman should be paid too. The women do great numbers and have huge social followings." And also, this person said that it was a huge deal for women in the industry who were paid a lot less than men. And then Meltzer says, "In the end, it's very clear that Khan is spending very big on new talent with the idea that it pays off with the television contract that will be negotiated this year." And that right there is the key. And I feel like that also is a message that is being lost with a lot of people. If Tony Khan thinks that throwing money at people like Okada and Will Ospreay and Mercedes is going to make the product more attractive and more desirable to Warner Brothers Discovery and is going to help them potentially secure a new deal with a rights increase, then it's worth it. Whether they're giving Okada $13 million over 3 years, or if that's exaggerated and he's getting half that, or if Mercedes is getting $5 million or $3 million a year, whatever it may be. If he believes that making these deals and bringing these people in is going to help get them a new deal with a rights increase, then they are worth it. Regardless of whether they pop a big number every Wednesday, if he thinks it's going to help net them $200 million a year, or $250 million a year, or $300 million a year for 3 or 4 years, then he is willing to pay through the nose to get that deal, because that deal is the single most important thing to him right now. He needs to make sure they get that renewal, and not just that they get the renewal for TNT and TBS, but they get the renewal and they get more money. Because he is paying a lot of money to these talents. His talent budget, I'm sure, is off the charts. He has to be able to not only pay his bills, but he wants the company to become profitable for the first time. So that deal, that negotiation, and they're in the negotiation window right now with Warner Brothers Discovery, that is the single most important thing right now to Tony Khan, as it should be. Now, I think they were going to get a new deal with Warner even without them, even without Okada and Ospreay and Mercedes. I said that when I did my predictions for this year. I said he's going to get a renewal and he's going to get a rights increase, and it's going to be for 3 or 4 years. But if he thinks this helps their chances, then you know what? It makes sense to do it. It makes sense to try. It may blow up in his face. But if that's where he's coming from, then it makes sense, and I understand it. Now, Mercedes coming back out at the end of the show on Wednesday to help Willow was interesting, because it was Mercedes who came out. It was Mercedes who came to the rescue, not Chris Statlander. Statlander had what she claimed was a medical emergency. She claimed that Julia Hart and Sky Blue were the ones who attacked her. That's why she couldn't come out. And now they've made a street fight for the live Rampage this Wednesday, because Rampage, because of the NCAA March Madness stuff, is bumped. So it's airing on Wednesday immediately after Dynamite, so you're getting a 3-hour block. They're doing a street fight. It's going to be Chris Statlander and Willow Nightingale against Julia Hart and Sky Blue. There is definitely a Chris Statlander heel turn coming. I mean, all you have to do is watch that segment they put on their socials after Wednesday where she said, "Oh, I was attacked. I had a medical emergency. I couldn't come out." It's very clear that this woman is going heel. And I think Statlander may be the first opponent for Mercedes. You know, Willow may end up going on to get a TBS title match with Julia Hart, but I think we may be getting Mercedes and Statlander first. But we had 2 very focused episodes of Dynamite the past 2 weeks. And I did see Collision last night. I actually think that Tony Schiavone and Nigel McGuinness as a 2-man booth, they're very good. I don't really miss Kevin Kelly being a part of that announce team. And Nigel in particular, he was having some fun on commentary last night. He was talking about Kyle O'Reilly. Yeah, and they've acknowledged that Kyle publicly has talked about the fact that he's a diabetic, and Nigel, he was making all kinds of, it was like Bobby Heenan on commentary last night. He was talking about, "I'm not going to sugarcoat this," and just making all kinds of cracks, and Tony was like, "Will you stop?" So they work very well together. I saw the Bryan Danielson-Katsuyori Shibata match. I thought that was very good. Again, it's crazy. I mean, that's a match 5 years ago, I would have said never. It's an impossibility. And there they were, not even on pay-per-view. There they were on television opening the show last night. But two very focused episodes over the last few weeks of Dynamite that I thought have been some of their best weekly shows all year. And it's also two straight weeks that they failed to crack 800,000 live viewers. The first number reported for this week's show was 801. And after they factored the overrun in the next day, they had like a 7-minute overrun, it actually dragged the total number down below 800 to 798. You don't usually hear about the overrun making the number lower. Usually it's the opposite, but it did in this case. And that's usually because there's such a big drop-off for their main events at the end of the show. I mean, if you look at the ratings pattern on most of these episodes of Dynamite, yeah, they start hot, and you could argue, well, that's because the lead-in from Big Bang Theory, and I'm sure that's part of it, and then it just usually is down from there. That big business number was disappointing, given the hype for it and the card they put together, which included an AEW World title match between Samoa Joe and Wardlow. May he rest in peace, by the way. Wardlow is done. Stick a fork in Wardlow. He's finished. So they had a world title match that they were advertising for this show, and that didn't help them at all. Now, it doesn't change my enjoyment level of the show. I had a lot of fun watching Dynamite on Wednesday, but for Tony Khan, who loves to boast when they do a big number, there's really no good way to spin that number. And it's like I said last week with the new signings. It's like, well, what should he do? What do you do? What should Tony Khan do to fix this? Just continue to focus on key stories and hope that over these coming weeks, because Ospreay, Okada, Mercedes, they've only just now been integrated into the weekly storylines in this company. So they're still brand new. Keep focusing on your core stories. Keep featuring these people on the show in prominent roles, right? And letting your audience know what they're doing and why they should care. And just continue to focus on that and hope that over these coming weeks, people who maybe tune the show out, and maybe they don't even know, they haven't even seen the show recently. They don't know that Okada and Mercedes and Ospreay are in, and that Samoa Joe is the champion, and this is going on, and that's going on. Hope that in these weeks to come, people maybe will give the show a second chance and like what they see, and they'll stick with it. Now, as far as ticket sales, Revolution sold out on the back of Sting's retirement match, and you only get one of those, unless you're Ric Flair. And they pulled close to 10,000 people in the building in Boston for Big Business, which was a very strong number, but it's the same old story with the other weekly shows where they're still struggling to sell tickets to fill these buildings. And in some cases, they're running smaller venues and they still can't pack them in. As they establish these new stars on their show, for all the money that Tony is paying them, he needs to hope that they get over enough that it translates into more tickets being sold. That, to me, is going to be the key. You know, Will Ospreay had that great match with Takeshita at Revolution. That was a great way to sort of kickstart things for him. But his first really big match is not until Dynasty. You know, he's going to be in one of the main events against Brian, if not the main event, against Brian Danielson. And they're going to continue to build him up for an eventual AEW World Championship match later in the year, maybe even by the end of the summer. Okada, again, just debuted on Dynamite. They turned him heel. He's part of the Elite. I'm enjoying the act so far, but he hasn't had a real meaningful match yet. He's going to be wrestling Eddie Kingston this Wednesday for the Continental title. I don't know why they're not waiting until Dynasty to do his first title match, but they're doing it on Dynamite this week. And then we have Mercedes, who literally just debuted and hasn't wrestled a single match yet. That'll be the real test. Once they're first in those big matches and they get them involved in a big program with somebody, and we let those programs develop and simmer over a period of time on TV, is the TV interesting enough to people that they want to tune in to see what's going on? I don't think you can really judge it at this point. There's no positive way to spin that number, but I don't think you can fully judge the three signings until you give them a little more time to actually get involved in something meaningful. And then we'll know whether or not it's working. This week's episode is sponsored by Factor. You know, I can be picky about what I eat and the products that I use, services I use, but every now and then I get to try something new. I recently tried out Factor Meals for the first time, and let me tell you something, I do not regret my decision. Okay, it's not just about eating food that tastes good, it's about eating good food. that's dietitian approved and comes delivered fresh, never frozen, ready to go in just 2 minutes. Factor is a meal delivery service that ships fresh, ready-made, chef-crafted meals right to your doorstep. With over 35 options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto meals. In fact, one of those Protein Plus meals I've got my eye on from their menu this week is the cilantro chicken with brown rice and black beans. I'm a chicken guy. I'm surprised I don't have feathers growing out of me with all the chicken I eat. But that's just one of many, and they have more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. So give it a try. You can fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. They have tons of options for the entire day, including pancakes for breakfast, smoothies, and more. They're also flexible to fit into your schedule, no matter how busy you may be. You can get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals each week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Factor is the perfect solution if you are looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. I'm not a very good cook. If I had to cook a fresh meal for myself every day, I would starve, okay? All right? So it's nice to be able to have a fresh meal to heat up without all the hassle. And when you sign up, you save. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/solomonster50 and use the code solomonster50 to get 50% off. That's code solomonster50 at factormeals.com/solomonster50 to get 50% off. Dark Side of the Ring this week was back to the kind of content that you would expect. Talking Marcus Alexander Bagwell, better known as Buff Bagwell in WCW, and for about a week in WWE. We went from the wholesome scene of Haku laughing at the Shockmaster last week to this week hearing about Bagwell's mom manscaping her son's balls for him. And this is when he was a grown-ass man in the NWO. The number of times that I thought to myself watching this, I just sat here and thought, what the fuck? Set a record for any Dark Side of the Ring episode that I have ever watched. One thing I did not know is how wealthy Bagwell's family was. He comes from a family of opulence. And according to former WCW and TNA referee Slick Johnson, who has been friends with Bagwell since he was 18 years old, Buff's father Steve owned a lumber company. Everybody in town got their lumber from the Bagwells. They knew the family, they knew the company. And his father was a self-made millionaire. The family had a pool, they had a tennis court, they had a movie theater in their home. And Steve bought Buff a Corvette when he was 15. When I was 15, I got to go to Disney World for the first time, so that sounds about even. And they also shared a heartwarming story about Steve, where he once lost a bet. And he got so angry that he grabbed his machine gun, because who among us doesn't keep a machine gun at home? He grabbed his machine gun, he went outside, and he unloaded an entire clip on a flock of geese in a fit of rage. Because that sounds like a perfectly rational response. That was the first what the fuck moment. The second what the fuck moment came when Steve went up to his son's room one night. He was there with his friends, they were getting ready to go out. And he asked them, where are you guys going tonight? And they told him, we're going to the club and some other places. So he pulled out 5 or 6 small bags of cocaine and he passed them out to all of Buff's friends and to Buff and told them, have fun. Now Buff justifies this by saying that his dad was worried about them and figured, well, at least the coke was coming from someplace that he trusted. Mind you, we hadn't even gotten to the wrestling portion of this documentary yet. But wait, there's more. Because now the family finances are not what they used to be. I can't imagine why. The business is struggling, times were tough, and his parents were fighting. And Buff's father, he was beating his mom. Marcus steps in to try to save his mom, and he's got a gun in his hand. Steve runs off to go grab his own gun. I don't know if it's the machine gun, but he went off to go grab his own gun. And we got ourselves a good old-fashioned standoff in the middle of this house. Marcus fires the first shot with the intent to kill his father. And it would have, had his father not gotten his hand up to his chest just in the nick of time. Bagwell fired 4 more times on his father, And Steve says, because his father's still alive, they interviewed him for this. His father's like, I couldn't believe what was going on. You know, beating up on mom will have that effect on a kid, you know? If I ever saw my father lift a finger to my mother, I'd have wanted to kill him too. I actually don't fault him for that. And then a few months later, they hashed it all out, and Mark has said that the two of them have been best friends ever since. What a happy ending. They interviewed several of Bagwell's ex-wives, maybe all of them. I don't know how many times this man has been married. I lost track. But he is still friends with his ex-wives. They were practically fawning over him by the end of this episode. I don't know what kind of voodoo magic he has worked on these women, but hey, good for him. It can't be what he's packing, because they interviewed Too Cold Scorpio for this, and he claimed that Bagwell has a tiny dick, which is something I didn't need to know. But if that's true, then maybe he's just a really nice guy. Maybe they like his personality. I don't know. But they still seem smitten with him. His first wife, Tanya, seems like a really nice lady. They got married. Marcus took a job as a male stripper right out of high school. You do what you gotta do to make money. He doesn't regret it. He doesn't shy away from it. He says, hey, you know, I didn't mind it. Do what you gotta do. He ends up meeting Missy Hyatt, who introduces herself as the First Lady of Wrestling. And I'm sorry, that title will forever belong to Miss Elizabeth. But Missy takes credit for discovering Marcus, who had no interest in getting into wrestling. It's not like they met at a wrestling show. I think she moved in near him and she saw him one day and thought he was, you know, gorgeous and, oh, he'd be perfect for, you know, professional wrestling. He didn't have any interest in wrestling. He told her, my brother wants to be a wrestler. And she said, your brother? You should try it. And he didn't think they made any money. And when she told him that their lowest paid guy was making $100,000 a year, he suddenly had a change of heart. So the deal he made with his wife is that I'm going to train and you're going to work. She worked at a club as a dancer and she hated it. But the agreement was, you support me, and once I make it, I will support you and you won't have to work anymore. I'll give you one guess as to how it worked out. Buff made it. He landed a job in WCW. He even won the tag team titles with Too Cold Scorpio. But then he cheated on his wife, and she just couldn't bring herself to forgive him. So that was the end of their marriage. So much for the agreement. I know in shoot interviews in the past, Bagwell and Scorpio did not speak highly of each other. They did not get along well behind the scenes when they teamed. Too Cold was interviewed for this, though. The next what the fuck story, what is this, number three? I think we're up to now, number three, was Bagwell deciding that he wanted to get calf implants. He was in search of the perfect body. He didn't like his calves. His father had great calves, his mom didn't, so he thinks he got them from his mom. He got the implants, and then he started having pain in his leg. And it got so bad that his friend, Slick Johnson, had to carry Buff on his back to the bathroom and sit him down on the toilet whenever he had to do his business. And then after he wiped his own ass, Slick would come back in, pick him up on his back and carry him out, put him on the couch. This went on for weeks until he finally went to the hospital and they told him his body was rejecting them and he had to have the calves taken out or else he ran the risk of having his legs amputated. Now, any normal, sane, rational individual would hear this and go, oh my God, of course, yes, take them out, by all means. I don't want to lose my legs, which includes my calves. By all means, take them out. But no, that was not the first thought that ran through his head. This idiot had to think about it. He admits that his first thought was, get them taken out or have my legs cut off. He was trying to figure out a way where he could keep them both. You know, I'm not so sure that Steve gave them the best cocaine after all. I don't know what that stuff was laced with. This guy's not too bright. So, of course, he had them taken out. And he still has the implants. Sitting in a box at home, they even showed him holding them. It was footage from a television series called Vanity Insanity from 2006. They did an entire episode devoted to Bagwell. I watched all 11 minutes of it on YouTube for research purposes. And yes, that is 11 minutes of my life that I can never have back. So he eventually lands another tag team partner. This is his third. So Too Cold Scorpio was his first partner. Then it was Del Wilkes, the Patriot. There were Stars and Stripes. Now it was Scotty Riggs. And they were the American Males. And they played that damn theme song, and now I can't get it out of my head. Eric Bischoff said the same thing in the episode. It's like, once you hear it, it's just stuck there for a while, and there's nothing you can do about it. So during this period, Bagwell meets his second wife, Erica. That doesn't last long. So then it's on to wife number three, Judy, who we also heard from. So we had his mom, Judy, and his wife, Judy. So we had two Judy Bagwells, if you're keeping track here. From there, Bagwell went heel. He joined the NWO. Kevin Nash said to him one day, "You want to join the NWO?" And he was like, "Yeah, of course." Of course, he went to Scotty and said, "Sorry, Scotty, I got to do this." Poor Scotty Riggs is left in a lurch. He's like, "All right, brother, if that's what you want to do, we'll make it work." And this is where the transformation into Buff took place. His first wife thought that there was still a chance that maybe they could get back together until she saw him on TV one day playing Buff, and that's when she knew there was no hope because he was basically living the gimmick. Then came what the fuck moment number four. And there is just no topping this. Okay, so think about everything I've talked about so far. This man shot his father. This man's father gave out bags of cocaine to him and his friends. Like, I mean, again, all of this stuff, the calf implants. But this was the topper of all toppers. I hate that I even heard about this because this was my first time. Apparently, this was a well-known story to some of the boys. Not only did we get the story, we got the reenactment too. So let's set the stage first. Okay, Buff hired his mother to be his personal assistant. And they came up with the idea to set up this little corporation. It was called the Real Buff Incorporated. And actually, he hired the whole family to work for him, and he paid them a salary. And basically, they would all do things to help him out, like take him to the airport. They would make sure his house was clean. They would make sure his bills were paid. All the stuff that he couldn't be bothered with, they had he had his family members doing for him. But his mother was the one. He was always very close to his mom. He was a mama's boy. And there's nothing wrong with being a mama's boy. Always had a very close relationship with her. Maybe a little too close. Slick Johnson tells the story of coming home one day. And he sees Mark's mom's car parked outside. He goes in and he heads up to Mark's room. And he's got a huge bathroom in there. And in the bathroom, the door is, I guess, wide open. I think the door was open, but maybe it wasn't. But in any event, he walks in. He finds Buff on all fours in his bathtub, buck naked. And his mom is standing behind him with the skin of his dick pulled up behind his balls. And she is shaving his balls for him. Buff turns around. I want you to process that. Buff turns around and says, "Oh, hey, buddy." Buff's mom turns around and says, "Oh, hey, how you doing? Is everything okay?" Like it's nothing. Like this is a normal everyday occurrence. Slick says, "You people are sick." And he walks out. Now, my mother isn't here anymore. But as I think back to some of the things that I have asked her for over the years, I can remember, you know, "Mom, can you pick me up from the train? Mom, can you take me to the doctor? I'm not feeling well. Mom, can you help me out with the podcast? I'm going to start taking phone calls on my streams. I want to test out this new line and make sure it works." I can't ever remember the thought crossing my mind to ask, "Hey, Mom, do you have a few minutes to shave my balls?" And if I had, she would have told me, "You've got two hands. Shave your own goddamn balls." From shooting his dad to hopping into the bathtub to have his mom manscape his balls. From bullets to ball sacks. The story of Marcus Alexander Bagwell. The book title writes itself. Then things take a serious turn. And they covered the neck injury that he suffered on WCW Thunder. It was April 22nd, 1998. Bagwell was only 28 years old at the time. He's in the prime of his career. He's doing the NWO thing. He was tagging with Scott Norton that night against Lex Luger and Rick Steiner. Steiner comes off the top rope for a bulldog. He missed Bagwell, or kind of like slipped past his head. And Bagwell went down with him for it anyway. Steiner hit the mat first. Buff was behind him, and his head jammed right into Steiner's back. And his neck snapped backwards. It looked sickening. At that point, he lost all feeling in his arms and legs. He thought he was paralyzed from the neck down. He laid there on that mat for almost half an hour while they tried to get the right type of stretcher out there for him. It took forever. I mean, today they would be on top of that in a matter of seconds. You go watch that segment back. They were scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan had to stall on commentary and got very somber. Yeah, because both of them had their own history of neck surgeries. So they knew how serious the situation was. I thought they handled it about as well as could be expected. A few hours later at the hospital, Buff could finally sit up and he got all the feeling back in his extremities because he only bruised his spinal cord, which is where all the swelling came from. Once the swelling went down, he got all the feeling back. It's basically the same injury that Steve Austin suffered in 1997 when Owen Hart dropped him on his head. He also bruised his spinal cord and had temporary paralysis. This was scarier, though, because he was laying there for so much longer. Austin, when he had the temporary paralysis, it was for maybe 30 seconds, 45 seconds, and then he started to crawl and they went right to the finish. Bagwell just laid there. He couldn't move for a long time. You know, it's like the swelling fools your spinal cord into thinking that you're paralyzed, which just sounds terrifying. Now, he did have to get 2 plates and 8 screws in his neck, but thankfully he was able to make a full recovery, and he was back on TV within 3 months. They were wheeling him out there in his wheelchair. And there was money to be made with a Buff Bagwell comeback, like a babyface comeback run. The fans were really behind him when he came back, when he first came out there in the wheelchair, and he might have had the neck brace on, and he was thanking everybody. Like, there was real sympathy for him. They were behind him. So what did WCW do? They did a swerve, and they turned him right back heel. Now, I don't know if a Buff Bagwell babyface run would have been successful or not. The fact is, he always came across as a smug, arrogant prick. I don't know if he could have pulled it off, but the fact that they didn't even try it is just pissing money down the drain. But, you know, then again, up against Hogan and all those top guys in the company, he probably didn't stand a chance anyway. But this is where he turns to drugs to mask the pain that he's in. And then we get to Judy Bagwell, the mother, not the wife. Judy Bagwell on WCW television. Rick Steiner loved Judy Bagwell. They were like best friends. I don't know how that happened, but it did. And Rick is the one who pitched the wild idea for Judy to become a character on the show. Buff loved the idea, and so they rolled with it, which included Judy becoming one half of the WCW World Tag Team Champions. Yes, it is part of the official record. She never worked an actual match, but Judy Bagwell was brought in to replace Rick Steiner's tag team partner, and she wore that WCW tag team title belt around her waist. Now, I actually think, in a way, it's kind of cool the way that Buff got to work with his mom like that. I don't think it made for great television, personally, although, you know, she still cut a better promo than most. If you go back and watch some of her promo work, you could tell that she was enjoying her 15 minutes of fame, but she was off TV not long after that. But not forever. Forever is a very long time. Fast forward 2 years. Vince Russo has now infected WCW, and we got the return of Judy Bagwell, the return that absolutely nobody asked for. They didn't spend much time on this in the episode, and I'll try not to also, but they brought her back for the feud between Buff and Chris Kanyon. Kanyon threw her into the trunk of his car and kidnapped her one day. This all led to the infamous Judy Bagwell on a pole match, where Buff had to win in order to get his mom back. And they couldn't actually find a pole to attach this woman to, so they settled for a forklift instead. So technically, it was a Judy Bagwell on a forklift match. And if Kanyon won, Judy would have to be his new valet. Nothing like some human trafficking on our wrestling show. At least this was just a storyline. Little did we know what would come all these many years later. That makes about as much sense, though, as Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio deciding the custody of Dominic in a ladder match. All I remember, as far as the actual match, is David Arquette made a run-in. He got involved in some way. The less said about this, the better. One of Russo's wonderful ideas from that time period. And not the only ridiculous idea that involved Buff Bagwell. They also did a DNA match, which was basically a first blood match. Now, why a DNA match? Because David Flair's girlfriend, on-screen girlfriend at the time, Stacy Keibler, got pregnant. And there was a sneaking suspicion that Buff might be the real father. So the object of the match was for David Flair to obtain a blood sample from Buff Bagwell that he could then rush to the back to hand off to a lab technician to confirm the paternity of Stacy's child and whether or not he was the father. 5 months later, WCW was dead. I can't imagine why. Now, another story they didn't mention, which happened around the same time as the Judy Bagwell garbage. Buff got arrested. This is a story he would rather not talk about, I'm sure, but he got arrested. At a Thunder taping, a stagehand for WCW was trying to leave the arena. He had, I guess, some carpet from the show. And Buff and a group of wrestlers were blocking the exit. And when the stagehand asked Buff to get by, Bagwell allegedly used a racial slur on him twice and then punched him. Police showed up. They were given eyewitness statements from people. They were given photos of the injury. And they arrested Buff. They arrested him for assault. Now, in shoot interviews since then, he has given his side of the story, which differs from what the stagehand said. You know, it's everyone else's fault. Everyone but him. It's everybody else's fault. I stopped watching one of these shoot interviews. I stopped watching halfway through his explanation because it's very clear in this one interview that he was hopped up on something. Either that or he was drunk, but I couldn't take anything he was saying seriously when he wasn't slurring his words. So, yeah, not a good look for Buff. He got suspended for that for 30 days by WCW. And then came the sale of WCW to WWE. Vince McMahon picks the bones, he wins the war, and now he gets to choose who to bring over. They played the clip of Vince on TV mentioning certain names, see what kind of reaction they would get, and the reaction to Buff's name was surprisingly strong, so he made the cut. Lex Luger did not make the cut. Jeff Jarrett did not make the cut. Booker T and Diamond Dallas Page, they made the cut because they took less money to sign with WWE. They had guaranteed Turner money. They could have sat home and collected, but they chose to sign with WWE. They wanted to work. And Buff Bagwell made the cut. Now, before he makes his debut, he's at a training session the day of. This is the day of his match with Booker T. And Shane Helms is one of the wrestlers in the ring working out. Now, there was some kind of an issue, I guess, maybe before this, that they didn't like each other. It sounds like there was a pre-existing issue between the two. But Shane... and this, by the way, he made some news this week when he responded to what Buff had to say here. We'll get to that in a second. But as Bagwell tells it in the episode, insults were thrown back and forth. Whoever started it, right? There are insults flying back and forth. And Helms ends up saying, well, at least I'm not a drug addict. Bagwell threatens to slap his teeth down his throat, and then he hits him with what he calls the Bagwell slap. Surprised he didn't trademark it. The Bagwell slap, he claims, is something his father taught him. It's a way to show dominance. And Shane gets knocked on his ass. He grabs what Bagwell says must have been a frozen water bottle that was sitting on the mat, and he blasts Bagwell on the back of the head with it. And now Bagwell is bleeding everywhere. But he doesn't say anything to anyone, even though he claims there's blood everywhere. It'd be pretty fucking hard to hide that, but... bleeding everywhere, doesn't say anything. He goes to his own doctor. He gets 25 staples put in his head to close the wound shut. He took a black Sharpie to cover up the staples in his head that night so that nobody would notice them when he was on TV wrestling Booker T. And he went out there and he wrestled. He blames that incident, the fight with Helms, for why he got fired by WWE, because he threw the first shot and so that's why I got fired. That's his version of events. Shane Helms has a slightly different version of events, which he made very clear on his Twitter this week. And before I get into what he said, let me read you what he told Sam Roberts about the incident. This was back on Sam's podcast in 2016. Shane said, he said something and I burned him really bad and he got all offended by it and he came and hit me in the damn ear. He's like standing on the floor and he outweighs me by 50 pounds anyway. Everybody in there knows I banged my shoulder up, so then he comes and hits me from behind, and I kind of just threw a water bottle at him like this, and then I jumped out of the ring, and this was just kind of to distract him, because now I'm going to go punch him in the face. But he fucking cracked his head open, and he was bleeding all over the place, and I'm like, oh fuck. I really didn't intend for it to do that, and I didn't think it would. I don't know, I guess the water in it made it harder. When I got to TV next week, the Acolytes, the APA, took my bags and put them on the WWE side. The locker room was really segregated in those days, WWE on one side, WCW on the other. Steve Austin came and pat me on the back. So that's what he said then, which honestly is not all that different from the version that Buff tells as far as the bottle being thrown and Buff gets cracked and he's bleeding. But he went on Twitter this week after the episode aired. He tore into Bagwell and he said, this is about the idea that he cost Buff his contract. He said, I didn't. Buff is a lying piece of shit. Always has been. There were witnesses there and no one agrees with Buff. He used to blame Jim Ross too. He blamed everybody except the man in the mirror. Nothing wrong with failing at something, but accountability is key. Everyone associated with that episode of Dorkside can suck ass. And when a fan noted that Bagwell seemed like a changed man after working with Diamond Dallas Page, Helms responded, he literally just went on a show and told a bunch of lies. No more second chances from me. And then another fan chimed in and said, not only is Buff a lying piece of shit, he robbed his friend, the father of two, and never made it right. And then the father of two then responded and said it had to do with Buff selling his WCW tag team belts. He claims he sent the money and he kept getting the runaround from Buff and he spent months giving him the benefit of the doubt, but then reality set in that he was dumb to send him the money. He said, I should have known better, but I thought I was helping him and getting something cool in return. I still got all the proof. Just left the situation alone because I see he's clearly never going to right his wrong. He put the blame on everybody else. Dude even said that he would send other items to make up for the money I lost, and he never did that either. So this turned into a whole thing on social media once Shane posted what he did. But here's the deal with him in WWE. And there were a lot of really terrible things that happened back then as far as the treatment of the WCW guys. I mean, I can get into the Chris Kanyon stuff and the way that he got treated. And as Shane himself said, there was segregation in the locker room. You're not one of us. You got to stay on that side. And there was a separation between the two. It was like fucking high school. But what happened is they gave Bagwell a shot, okay, even after the assault charge from the year before. And then the fight with Helms. They featured him in the main event of Monday Night Raw in Tacoma, Washington. It was against Booker T. Jim Ross and Paul Heyman, they tagged out to let Scott Hudson and Arn Anderson do commentary for the match. They brought out a WCW referee, Nick Patrick. They put WCW logos all over the screen and all over the arena. They had Shane McMahon come out. He was the leader of WCW. For one night, it basically, in that main event, became WCW Raw. And the fans took a giant dump all over it. How can you blame them? At every turn, for years, Vince McMahon convinced his fans that WCW and everybody associated with WCW, they were the enemy. And they were number two, and we were number one. Then they do this invasion and storyline where the WCW guys invade. And you've got Booker T out there beating up Steve Austin and beating up WWE talent. So now you're taking Booker T and you're having him wrestle Buff Bagwell, who's never appeared on WWE television ever, and who actually is a heel. All the WCW stars were made to look like geeks, including DDP. They had DDP feuding with The Undertaker's wife and doing jobs for The Undertaker's wife. And the way The Undertaker, by the way, and he's as much to blame as anybody for this, the way The Undertaker was complicit in the booking and the way they treated DDP is fucking despicable. But this match here in Tacoma, this was set up to fail before the bell even rang. You can't position WCW as the loser brand and then make a random WCW main event on a show where people paid to see WWE guys. That doesn't work. The match itself was not the worst that I've ever seen. It wasn't very good, but it wasn't like the worst match I've ever seen. But for the spot that it was put in, it failed. It failed to showcase why people should give a shit about WCW. It had one objective. Objective failed. The biggest reaction to anything in the match is when they sent Steve Austin and Kurt Angle into the ring to beat the piss out of Booker T and cause the disqualification, which meant the match was finally over. That got the biggest pop of the entire match. And then at the very end of the show, they have Austin and Angle literally throw Booker T out of the building with some help from Buff. Buff was actually helping them. And then was made to look like a complete tool because they turned on Bagwell and they threw him out of the building too. This match, let me explain to you how much of an epic failure this match was. This match was such an epic failure that Vince McMahon abandoned all plans that he had to run WCW as a separate brand. And there were plans to run WCW as its own brand. Okay, that same night in Tacoma, they had a show-long storyline with Tori Wilson trying to win herself a job by making out with Vince McMahon, only for Linda to catch him with his pants down at the end of the show. Okay, I'm sure some of you remember that. It did air. It aired on TV. And then the story was dropped. Well, what was going to happen is that in the divorce between Vince and Linda, in dividing the family assets, Linda would get control of Raw, and Shane McMahon would end up leading WCW on USA every Monday night. Vince would run WWE with SmackDown on UPN on Thursdays. Plans were far enough along with this that they had arenas booked for the WCW tapings on Mondays. I mean, they already had buildings booked. Like the brand split with Raw and SmackDown that came the following year, that's what was supposed to be WWF against WCW. Vince against Shane. That's what it was supposed to be. But then Tacoma happened. That and Kevin Dunn was in Vince's ear for weeks, trying to talk him out of this. He was trying to tell him, you can't have WCW stars beating WWF stars because, you know, WWF was the superior brand and all and blah, blah, blah. So he played a part in it too. Tacoma was just the icing on the cake. And then the next morning, he pulled the plug on the entire thing. They did the Invasion pay-per-view a few weeks later that did a huge buy rate. I think the biggest non-WrestleMania buy rate they've ever done. And that was the end of any kind of war between the two companies. WCW was dead for good. And we got that watered-down Invasion shit that will go down as the single biggest missed opportunity creatively in the history of WWE. Now, the funny thing is, the week after Tacoma, Raw was in Atlanta, which was WCW's backyard. That was Turner Country. Had they waited a week to book that match, maybe the crowd reaction would have been a little bit more favorable. Maybe history would have been different. But the reality is, if they were going to book WCW like shit, it wasn't going to matter what city they were in. They were booked to fail from the start. Bagwell was fired a week later. He blamed it on the fight between Shane Helms. In the past, he's blamed it on Jim Ross. He blames JR for spreading this rumor about his mom calling the office and asking if Buff could get some live event date off, I think it was. JR has said that Judy had nothing to do with Buff getting fired. It was a Vince McMahon call. Vince did not see money in Buff. Buff had a higher opinion of his work than Vince did. And JR was the hatchet man who had to deliver the bad news. That was his job as the head of talent relations. And you've heard that from people over the years, and it's always a funny thing. It's like, well, you know, this guy, you know, JR didn't like me. This person didn't like me. Vince liked me. It's the evil Jim Ross who didn't like me. No, you dumb shit. Vince didn't like you. He just had Jim Ross do his dirty work for him. So Buff's addictions got the better of him after this. He drank. He did drugs to cope. There was an awful car wreck that he was involved in where he almost died. When he recovered, he needed to make money, so he ends up paying, or being paid, $25,000 to do a show called Gigolos. And it was like a reality show, and he thought he was coming on to mentor the other guys on the show. And he claims he had no idea that it basically was softcore porn. And now he's got to go tell his poor wife. And then after that, he joined a website called Cowboys for Angels, and he became a male escort. And of course, the first woman that he meets falls in love with him, and he starts to fall in love with her. And so ends marriage number three. Then there's another car wreck, and there's multiple DUIs. Things are spiraling out of control, and then he finds out that his mother has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, which is terrible. And she passes away. And that was a wake-up call for Marcus to get sober, or else the rest of his family was going to leave him. He was going to be all by himself. And if there's one thing that is very evident from watching this special and listening to this man throughout the episode, he does not want to be by himself. He needs to have other people around him, whether it's to do things for him or just support him in some way. So I could see where that would be a wake-up call for him, like, oh shit, if I don't get my act together, I'm not going to have anybody that I can lean on anymore. I'm not going to have anybody. Enter Diamond Dallas Page, who should be given his own wing in the Hall of Fame at this point. If anybody deserves the Warrior Award, it's DDP for all the wrestlers that he has saved. And you can find videos on the DDPY YouTube channel. They brought in Bagwell, and it was rough there for a while. You know, he was still having issues, and DDP is trying to hammer it home. Like, bro, this is what you need to do. And, you know, it looks like he got himself clean. He's got himself in a much better place now. But he says that Dark Side of the Ring called him about doing an episode on him, and Scotty Riggs was going to be part of the episode. So he decided to reach out to Scotty Riggs. He's like, well, I was going to reach out to him anyway. It's been a while. He reaches out to Scotty Riggs. Scotty, it turns out, had been living in his car for about 6 weeks because he was trying to help out his mom who was sick. And I think she may have passed away and he lost his house. Like, he had really fallen on some very tough times. Scotty, who's interviewed for this, says he was this close to putting a gun to his chest. He was suicidal when Marcus reached out to him. And Bagwell could tell, just based on talking to him over the phone, something wasn't right. You know, you got to come up here. You got to come up here. Come to the crib here. DDP's got me here and I'm doing well. And we'll get you up here. It'll be good for you. And he didn't want to do it. He's like, nah, I don't think so. Like, I don't know if it's a pride thing or what. He's like, ah, you know, and the tires on my car, I need new tires. And, you know, Bagwell was like, look, bro, like, you contact your local mechanic or shop or whatever. You put them in touch with me. I'll pay for them. And even Bagwell's like, for me to offer to pay for anything for anyone is like, okay, that just doesn't happen. But, like, I'll pay for them myself. We'll make the arrangements. You'll have new tires. But you got to drive up here. And he wouldn't let it go. So good on him, because he stayed on top of him, and eventually, you know, Scotty relented, and Riggs drove up to where they are there in Georgia. And again, he was in a bad spot. And he looks like another man now. He looks like a new person. He was actually in the front row at Revolution for Sting's final match. And you wouldn't even be able to recognize that it's the same person that you remember from WCW. And there's also, again, a great video up on the DDPY channel that talks about Scotty's story. They only dedicated a few minutes to the DDP stuff at the end of this episode. There's a longer video that you can watch online that goes into greater detail about where, you know, Bagwell and Riggs were and how much better they seem to be doing now. Riggs, I think, is a far more sympathetic figure than Bagwell is. Like, if you look up his story and how they have been able to help him turn his life around, and one of the things that he was really upset about and depressed about, he had no teeth. Or the teeth he had were just in rough shape. He needed new teeth, and he was very self-conscious about that. And once DDP realized how serious he was, like, he saw that he was putting the work in and doing the program and getting himself back in good shape, and he realized, okay, this dude is serious. They arranged for this clinic that has brand new teeth made up to do that for Scotty Riggs. And again, he didn't have to pay for it or anything. And they filmed all of this. And he, you know, the day he gets his new teeth and everything, like, it's great. Like, it's a great story. And like I said, he comes across as a far more sympathetic figure who just happened to come into tough times because of the circumstances that were dealt to him with his family. Like I said, he ended up losing his home as a result. He was trying to take care of his mother. Bagwell was the cause of his own grief in a lot of ways. Even though he wants to blame this, that, and the other, you know, he doesn't come across as someone who willingly takes responsibility for the problems in his own life that he's caused. He caused a lot of his own grief. Now, I hope he has genuinely turned his life around. I do. And DDP is a saint for helping him. But time will tell. At least he's still around to tell his story. But the Scotty Riggs transformation is just something that I think is worthy of more than just the 2 minutes that it got here at the end of this episode. They devoted more time to, in the John Tenta episode last week, to the Shockmaster than they did poor Scotty Riggs here in this episode. But definitely check that video out. It's worth watching. And I'm glad he's in a much better place now. No mailbag this week. I gotta get out of here, but we're gonna try to get back to the mailbag next week. So keep sending in your questions. I got them all over here, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Always remember, include your name and where you are from when you write in. That will help your chances of me picking your question out so I can read it on the air so that everybody can hear it. This week, I'm going to be live at all the usual times for Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown on the YouTube channel. We got a face-to-face coming up on Friday night between Roman Reigns. Remember him? Roman Reigns, who's kind of been background noise on this road to WrestleMania. Him and Cody Rhodes. Definitely follow on the YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe there. And of course, next Sunday, I'm going to be back here for a brand new Sound Off. That's going to be episode 854. As we inch closer to WrestleMania weekend in Philly, and I hope you will join me for the ride. So until then, be well, stay safe, show some love to our sponsors here, if you would, and got some cool offers there for you, and I will see you back here for 8:54 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Kareem points out, we celebrated the fact that we just had our first full week, all bells and be the booker. But we have a pay-per-view. I may have celebrated a little too soon. The Green Pianist says, Kareem is the kid in class that reminds the teacher about homework.
Teacher, oh teacher, you forgot to give us homework. We need homework. You have one more be the booker. Don't forget. One more! Teacher!
I say tomorrow we hang Kareem upside down and shake him so his lunch money falls out of his pocket. And then we'll throw him in his locker and we'll lock him in there. How about that?
Teacher!
The Solomonster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow The Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster sounds off.